Let me go ahead and get a couple of world things out of the way here. Their hopes fading and legal opinions now exhausted and all the options. Terry Schiavo's parents appeared quietly resigned today, Sunday, to watching her die, but could claim one Easter victory. The severely brain-damaged woman received a drop of communion wine on her tongue, her only sustenance in 9 days. After her husband allowed her to receive the sacrament, outside the hospice where Schiavo is being cared for, five protesters were arrested. About a half dozen people in wheelchairs got out of them, lay in the driveway shouting, "We're not dead yet." The word I've received is that Terry Schiavo is now really past the point where even heroics would help her. And the family itself seems resigned, has asked the protesters to go home. In other words, I guess they feel it's over for Terry. They don't, or they've stopped wanting intervention at this point, I guess. And so maybe with that from the family and knowing it has reached that point, perhaps we could ask the same of you tonight. In other words, whichever side of this great war, this moral war that you were on, it's ending. You know, it's going to end. They're going to, you know, and now if you look at some websites, you'll see that they're fighting over the body that isn't even a body yet. Pope John Paul II delivered an Easter Sunday blessing to tens of thousands in St. Peter's Square, but the ailing pontiff, unable to speak, and managed only to greet the saddened crowd with the sign of the cross, bringing tears to many eyes. Al-Qaeda in Iraq released a video Sunday claiming to show the murder of an Interior Ministry official, and indeed Iraq says one is missing, so I guess that was him. Declaring himself completely innocent of child molestation charges, Michael Jackson said Sunday he is the victim of a conspiracy and asked fans around the world to pray for him. He apparently was interviewed by the Reverend Jesse Jackson. All right, now in a moment, I'm going to read to you a portion, I don't know, a fair portion, I guess, of a Rolling Stone article, just printed, called The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler. And I want you to absorb what I'm about to say, or as much of it as you can, because I have questions. I have some doozies. I really have some questions that I've cooked up for all of you out there. I'll share those with you after you listen, and I really do want you to listen to this coming up in just one moment. Again, it'll be by Howard Kunstler. It was published in Rolling Stone. It will frame what we're going to do tonight. Stay right where you are. Originally, I was seeking a guest for this program, maybe to talk about peak oil and the economic impact on America and when it would happen and all the rest of that, but there was really nobody qualified that we found. Somebody who could talk about peak oil only, but not the economic impact and what the world, you know, what the world is doing geopolitically right now. So I finally said, the heck with it. I don't need a guest. We'll do this show ourselves, and we will. Let's begin this way. Here it is. Again, this was Howard Kunstler, actually, in the Rolling Stone magazine, just published. A few weeks ago, the price of oil ratcheted above $55 a barrel. Now it's about $20 a barrel more than a year ago. Next day, the oil story was buried on page six of the New York Times business section. Apparently, price of oil is not considered significant news, even when it goes up $5 a barrel in a span of 10 days. That same day, the stock market shot up more than 100 points because CNN said the government data showed no signs of inflation. Note to clueless nation, call planet Earth. Carl Jung, one of the fathers of psychology, famously remarked that people cannot stand too much reality. What you're about to hear might challenge your assumptions about the kind of world we live in, and especially the kind of world into which events are propelling us. We're in for one rough ride through uncharted territory. It's been very hard for Americans, lost in dark raptures of non-stop infotainment, recreational shopping, and compulsive motoring to make any sense at all of the gathering forces that are going to fundamentally alter the terms of everyday life in our technological society. Even after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, America is still sleepwalking into the future. I call this coming time the long emergency. Most immediately, we face the end of the cheap fossil fuel era. It's no exaggeration to state that reliable supplies of cheap oil and natural gas underlie everything we identify as the necessities of our modern life, not to mention all of its comforts, its luxuries, central heating, air conditioning, cars, airplanes, electric lights, inexpensive clothing, recorded music, movies, hip replacement surgery, national defense, you name it. The few Americans who are not even aware that there is a gathering global energy predicament usually misunderstand the core of the whole argument. The argument states that we don't have to run out of oil and gas to start having severe problems with industrial civilization and its dependent systems. We only have to slip over the all-time production peak and begin a slide down the arc of steady depletion. The term global oil production peak means a turning point's going to come. When the world produces the most oil it's going to ever produce in a given year, and after that, yearly production will inexorably decline. It is usually represented graphically in a bell curve. Peak is up there at the top of the curve, the halfway point of the world's all-time total endowment, meaning half the world's oil will be left. And it seems like a lot of oil, and it is, but there's a very large catch. It's the half that's a whole lot more difficult to extract, far more costly to get, much poorer quality, and located mostly in places where the people hate our guts. A substantial amount of it will never be extracted. The U.S. passed its own oil peak, did you know this, about 11 million barrels a day in 1970. Since then, production has dropped steadily. In 2004, it ran about 5 million barrels a day, got a tad more from natural gas, yet we consume about 20 million barrels a day now. That means we have to import about two-thirds of our oil, and that ratio is going to continue to worsen. The U.S. peak in 1970 brought on a portentous change in geoeconomic power. Within a few years, foreign producers, chiefly OPEC, were setting the price of oil, and that in turn led to the oil crisis of the 1970s. In response, frantic development of non-OPEC oil, especially the North Sea fields of England and Norway, essentially saved the West's ass for about two decades. Since 1999, these fields have entered depletion. Meanwhile, worldwide discovery of new oil has steadily declined to insignificant, that's an important word, insignificant levels in 2003 and 4. Some cornucopians claim that the Earth has some kind of creamy nugget center, or oil, in other words, that's going to naturally replenish the great oil fields of the world. The facts speak differently, of course. There has been no replacement whatsoever of oil already extracted from the fields of America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world. Now we're faced with the global oil production peak. Best estimates of when this will actually happen have been somewhere between now and 2010. In 2004, however, after demand from burgeoning China and India, and they want a lot, shot up, and revelations that Shell Oil wildly misstated its reserves, and Saudi Arabia proved incapable of goosing up its production despite promises to do so, the most knowledgeable experts revised their predictions and now concur that 2005 now is apt to be the year of the all-time peak global production. It will change everything about how we live. To aggravate matters, American natural gas production is also declining at 5% a year, despite frenetic new drilling and with the potential of much steeper declines ahead because the oil crisis of the 1970s, nuclear plant disasters at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, and the acid rain problem, the U.S. chose to make gas its first choice for electric power generation. Result was, just about every power plant built after 1980 has to run on, guess what, gas. Half the homes in America are heated with gas. To further complicate matters, gas is not easy to import here in North America. It's distributed through a vast pipeline network. Gas imported from overseas would have to come to us compressed at about minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit in pressurized tanker ships, then get unloaded at special terminals. Very few of those exist in America. Moreover, they're tempting targets for terrorism. Some other things about the global energy predicament are poorly understood by the public and even our leaders. This is going to be a permanent energy crisis, and these energy problems will synergize with the disruptions of climate change, epidemic disease, and population overshoot to produce higher orders of trouble. We'll have to accommodate ourselves to fundamentally changed conditions. No combination of alternative fuels will allow America to have the kind of life we've become accustomed to, or even a substantial portion of it. The wonders of steady technological process achieved through the reign of cheap oil have lulled us into kind of a Jimmy Cricket syndrome, leading many Americans to believe that anything we wish for hard enough is going to come true. These days, even people who ought to know better are wishing ardently for a seamless transition from fossil fuels to whatever might replace them. The widely touted hydrogen economy is a particularly cruel hoax. We're not going to replace the U.S. automobile and truck fleets with vehicles run on fuel cells, for one thing. The current generation of fuel cells is largely designed to run on hydrogen obtained from natural gas. The other way to get hydrogen in the quantities wished for would be electrolysis of water using power from hundreds of nuclear power plants. Apart from the very dim prospect of our building that many nuclear plants soon enough, there are also numerous severe problems with hydrogen's nature as an element that present foreboding obstacles to its use as a replacement for oil and gas, especially in storage and transplant. Make that transport. Wishful notions about our rescuing our way of life with renewables are also rather unrealistic. Solar electric systems and wind turbines face not only the enormous problem of scale, but the fact that the components require substantial amounts of energy to manufacture and the probability that they can't be manufactured at all without the underlying support platform of a fossil fuel economy. We will surely use solar and wind technology to generate some electricity for some period ahead, but probably at a very local and small scale. Virtually all biomass schemes for using plants to create liquid fuels cannot be scaled up enough, or even a fraction of the level they're going to have to run things on now. What's more, these schemes are predicated on using oil and gas inputs, fertilizers, weed killers, to grow the biomass crops that would be converted into ethanol or biodiesel fuels. This is a net energy loser. You might as well burn the inputs and not bother with the biomass products. Coal is far less versatile than oil and gas and is less abundant in supplies than many people assume, fraught with huge ecological drawbacks as a contributor to greenhouse global warming gases and many health and toxicity issues, ranging all the way from widespread mercury poisoning to acid rain. You can make synthetic oil from coal, but the only time this was ever tried on a large scale was by the Nazis under wartime conditions, using very impressive amounts of slave labor. If we wish to keep the lights on in America after 2020, we may indeed have to resort to nuclear power with all its practical problems and eco-conundrums. Under optimal conditions, it could take 10 years to get a new generation of nuclear power plants into operation, and the price may be beyond our means. Uranium, incidentally, is also a resource in finite supply. We are no closer to the more difficult project of atomic fusion, by the way, than we were in the 1970s. Kunstler goes on, suburbia, American suburbia, will come to be regarded as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. And he says it has a tragic destiny. The successful regions in the 21st century are going to be the ones surrounded by viable farming hinterlands that can reconstitute locally sustainable economies on an armature of civic cohesion. Small towns and smaller cities have better prospects than the big cities, which will probably have to contract substantially. The process is going to be painful and tumultuous. In many American cities, such as Cleveland, Detroit, St. Louis, the process is already well advanced. Others have further to fall. New York and Chicago face extraordinary difficulties, being oversupplied with gigantic buildings out of scale with the reality of declining energy supplies. Their former agricultural hinterlands have long since been paved over. Still, our cities occupy important sites. Some kind of urban entities will exist where they are in the future, but probably not the colossi of the 21st century industrialism. Some regions of the country are going to do better than others in the long emergency. The Southwest will suffer in proportion to the degree that it prospered during the cheap oil blowout of the late 20th century, I predict. Sunbelt states like Arizona and Nevada will become significantly depopulated. Since the region will be short of water as well as gasoline and natural gas, imagine Phoenix without cheap air conditioning. Unimaginable, actually. I'm not optimistic, he says, about the Southeast either, for different reasons. I think it'll be subject to a substantial level of violence as the grievances of the formerly middle class boil over and collide with the delusions of Pentecostal Christian extremism. The latent encoded behavior of Southern culture includes an outsized notion of individualism and the belief that firearms ought to be used in the defense of it. This is a poor recipe for civic cohesion. The Mountain States and Great Plains will face an array of problems, from poor farming potential to water shortages to population loss. The Pacific Northwest, New England, and the Upper Midwest are somewhat better. They have better prospects. I regard them as less likely to fall into lawlessness, anarchy, or despotism, and more likely to salvage the bits and pieces of our best social traditions and keep them operational at some level. These are daunting, even dreadful prospects. The long emergency is going to be a tremendous trauma for the human race. We will not believe that this is happening to us. That 200 years of the modern world can be brought to its knees by a worldwide power shortage. The survivors will have to cultivate a religion of hope. That is, a deep and comprehensive belief that humanity is worth carrying on. If there is any positive side to stark changes coming our way, it may be in the benefits of close communal relations, of having to really work intimately and physically with our neighbors, to be part of an enterprise that really matters, and to be fully engaged in meaningful social enactments instead of being merely entertained to avoid boredom. Years from now, when we hear singing at all, we will hear ourselves, and we will sing with our whole hearts.
All right.
So the words of Howard Kunstler, not necessarily mine. However, I buy into it sufficiently. I've had any number of guests on the subject of peak oil. And so clearly I think I believe that. And I believe the basic tenets of this article, perhaps not some of the social conclusions toward the end that he had. And by the way, I skipped portions of it, some rather substantial portions of it, so I definitely recommend that you go to Rolling Stone, read the whole thing. Still, it kind of sets up the criticality, the degree of criticality of the situation. So I've come up with a number of questions for you, and I would only ask that you answer them honestly. That's all. Five simple, well, not so simple questions. One, do you believe what you just heard, that the crisis, the oil crisis just described, is real? Do you think the thing is real? Are we really facing it, or is it just all some sort of grand conspiracy? Is it not real? We've got more, hell, we've got more oil than we could ever use. I don't care about Japan and India and China and what they're telling us. Is it real? That's the first question. The second question is, do you think most Americans can accept the amount of reality that you just heard? Assuming that you do accept it as real, do you think most Americans can accept that level of reality? Now, three, at what pump price would, and I want you to think about this, at what pump price would your current lifestyle be unsustainable? It's already getting high out there. It's already getting expensive out there, folks. So at what pump price would your current life, as you lead it, become unsustainable? Four, would you, if it came to it, would you steal or even kill to feed your family. That's number four. Be aware that whether or not you call about this, I still may pummel you with these questions. I am really, really curious about these questions. How much reality sort of the American people can accept? This may be beyond what they can accept reasonably. I really have considered. Anyway, here we go. To the phone lines we go. First time caller line, you are on the air. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
What's your first name, please?
This is James.
Okay. Okay, James.
Winona, Minnesota.
Yes, sir.
Yes. One question, or the answer to your question is gas price.
The question was, at what pump price?
Yeah, pump price.
Would your life, as you know, as you have it now, be unsustainable? Maybe you wouldn't be able to get back and forth, afford to get back and forth to work, whatever.
I would say roughly around $4.
About $4, huh?
Yes. Huh. I'd say at that time I would be working with my family, and we'd try to pool together and try to do all our chores and shopping and all that.
All right, let's go backwards a little bit.
Yeah.
Because the first question, I guess, is the most relevant. Do you think the crisis, as I outlined it through that article, is real? Is it real?
I don't really think so. Mm. But I don't have enough information to really determine. But I don't think there is.
Meaning you think that there's enough oil in the ground to go round?
For some time. Obviously I don't know what's down there, but...
Well, as the price at the pump goes from $4, say, to $5,
yes.
You know, then things begin to happen on their own, sort of, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so it could really get rough out there.
Yes.
It really could.
Right.
And, you know, it could get to the point where people, I guess, get down to whether they would steal or even kill to feed their family, or would they see their family starve to death?
No, I wouldn't think so.
Probably not, huh?
No.
And then the question then shifts to the whole country and whether, as a nation, you know, most presidents we've had, in all my memory as an adult, have said that we would, in a second, go to war to protect access to the Persian Gulf so the oil could keep coming. We would go to war for that. So, you know.
Yes, I think we would.
Hmm.
There's a lot riding on it right now, I would say. Once these alternatives come around and are, you know, we can afford them.
This Kostler article was pretty rough on the alternatives. It was like saying,
yes,
there's none that really will work. Not to replace what we're losing.
Right.
It'll be a different world. All right, thank you very much for your responses. I appreciate it. Be a very different world. There, you know, he's sort of... I'm not sure that I'm as pessimistic as Kunstler is in this article. He is pretty pessimistic. And you know me, I can be very pessimistic and cynical and all the rest of it. And I don't think it's going to get... I hope it's not going to get down to that. But one can see that if anything could do it, This would be what could do it. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, excellent topic you have tonight. Art's Robert from Los Angeles.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of a no-brainer. Our government's been run by the oil corporations. I mean, Ronald Reagan was funded by Arco Oil, and the Bush administration, the Mobil. ExxonMobil was tied in deep with, and all this is advantage of it.
Sir, oil is propelling our nation. These presidents have to be oil presidents, right now anyway,
yes.
Until it's gone, and then we're going to need somebody else.
You remember when the artificial prices went up really quick, and everybody wondered, why is oil going up so high, and the barrel is still only $21 a barrel of oil?
I remember.
And then they go, oh, my God, you know, we forgot to raise the price of oil. So they drop gas down for a couple of weeks. And then they try to figure out how to manipulate it again. It raised up, and they're investigated. And they're investigated. They investigated four or five times. And they said, okay, let's raise the price of the barrel of oil. See, it's all manipulation. They're just taking advantage and stealing billions of dollars.
Well, with China and India now, it's up to $55 a barrel. There's no such thing as local oil really anymore. I mean, it's all world spot oil, so it's a world price, you know, whatever. It's a demand market. We want the oil. We'll pay X number of dollars. We'll get it for now. But at some point, there won't be any to sell at any price almost. Or right. at least before we ever get to that conundrum, we get to the we can't afford it anyway price.
Yeah. But, you know, everybody's heard this. They're intentionally holding back oil to drive the price up. And then they're coming back to say that we need to stock our military surplus and reserves and all this and that, which
okay,
is
so
a lie.
You don't believe that the crisis is real at all.
The crisis is in the White House. If we were to have accidentally a Democrat and a president, there would be lawsuits and people in prison like Enron. There would be people in jail right now. Gas would be, there'd be a lawsuit settled. And the gas price would be adjusted to about 59 cents a gallon to compensate from the...
You think a Democrat would get it down to 59 cents, huh?
Due to a lawsuit, yeah. They would say, well, offset the price. This is how much you gouged everybody. And
okay.
It's 59 cents for approximately 2 years.
All right. Well, I accept what you've said, but I think it's delusional. I don't think any lawsuit's going to bring oil down to 59 cents a gallon. None of us are going to live to see that again. I'm sorry, I don't buy into that because it is a world price. It's not just the U.S. that wants oil anymore. It's not just the U.S. buying oil. Hell, some of our oil from Alaska goes to Japan, right? And then we import oil from elsewhere. And so this is a world oil price. It's not a U.S. oil price, even though I'm sure our oil companies manipulate the hell out of prices sometimes. You know they do. We all know they do. Summertime comes, we drive, they raise the price of gas. But this is kind of beyond that. These questions that I'm asking go beyond that. Go beyond the little annoyances and misdoings that they might have done. This goes to the world supply of oil, and that's out of even their hands. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Is this East?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Art, it's Diane in Southwest Florida.
Well, good morning, Diane.
Good morning. I think it's all a conspiracy, and I'll tell you why. 57% of our oil comes from Mexico and Canada. We don't even get that much from the Mideast. When boots first touched down in Iraq, the soldiers, if you'll remember, when it was live on the news nationwide, their boots were being soaked with oil just walking on the ground. And they were worried about the one huge oil well there in Tikrit because it has enough oil in it. They said right on the nation's news, to do every man, woman, and child out of that one oil well alone for the next 300 years. And then now, all of a sudden, 2 years later, they're forgetting that this was on the TV. OPEC does not set the prices for oil. The mercantile up in New York does.
Well, it's a world spot price. It's not just the U.S. It's the same price China pays everybody else.
And as for food, I would grow my own. And if somebody come to steal my food, I would kill them. I would not go out and kill someone else for their food.
Even if it came down to your family starving?
I would not let my family starve. I would go out, plow the ground.
But when they came to take your lettuce, you'd riddle them, fill them full of lead.
Yes, I would shoot them.
Got it. All right. Thank you very much for the call. And take care. It's going to be, I think, instructive for many of us to listen to what people say this morning. Don't take everything you hear as gospel. You know, people hear a lot of things. It doesn't make them so. Certain statistics regarding, for example, the amount of oil in Iraq may or may not be true. I don't know about supplying every man, woman, and child for 300 years. I'm not sure all the known reserves are going to do that. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi there. It's Sean in Vancouver, Canada.
Sean, you're going to have to raise your voice a little. You not
too
loud. Much better.
Oh,
close
you.
To the phone there.
Alrighty. I think there's a lot of contravesty with pricing and delirium about what's out there and what's not. And I think, much as I hate to say it, I think there's just too much decadence in our politics and too much, corruption given Iran-Contra. I mean, I don't know how you feel about the Marines' participation in that. My son and I are fourth and fifth generation armed forces up here, and we just think that a lot of lies are being told, a lot of lives are being wasted, and you've got the Cheney News Network or the Carlisle News Network saying one thing for Bush. And
all right, so you think this whole oil thing is baloney?
I think they're leading us into a global tyranny scenario where they want to lock us down based on all sorts of diversions and strife. And
you're saying a lot of words, but you're not answering the question yet. Is the whole oil crisis real or not real?
I think more than likely it's not real, and their profit margins prove that.
Their profit, that's an interesting comment. Their profit margins are pretty incredible, all right. They're making tons of money. I've got article after article after article here, and I've got something or another somewhere on what their record profits, I can tell you right now, without reaching the article. Yeah, here we go. All right, this is in pounds, you know. The announcement of world record profits for both Shell and BP in recent weeks has sparked a debate in the UK over the need for a proposed windfall tax on oil company profits, a windfall tax. BP enjoyed annual profits of 8.7 billion pounds. Oh, baby. A rise of 26% on the previous year. Shell recorded profits of 9.4 billion for the year, around a million an hour. A million pounds an hour. So they're making a lot of money. There's no question about that. International Line, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Great. Thank you for allowing me to answer the questions, Mr. Bell. First of all, I'd like to speak.
Okay, this is art. There's no one else here. I'm the only one. So.
Okay. Well, thank you.
So you want to try them, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Do you think the crisis is real or baloney?
I actually think it's quite real, or it's starting to obviously grow into something that's going to make our eyes wake up. Maybe look at going to, you know, soybean for gas. I think that might be a good option also to, you know, for our environment.
Okay, so you think it's real?
I do.
That means that you think, you're going to have a lot of other opinions then. For example, every day now we go to the gas station and, oh, man, oh, baby, there's a lot of shock there. I mean, really, a lot of shock.
Every Monday morning.
Yeah, you've got it. So, I mean, it just rises like crazy. At what price?
Well, I'm in Canada, so right now we pay approximately, tonight it was 83.5 cents a liter, so there's 4 liters in a gallon. So for American viewers, we're currently paying in London, Ontario, $3.34 a gallon.
Yikes. We don't have viewers in either country. We have listeners, though. And
So
$3.34 or so per gallon.
Yes, there, per gallon.
All right. Where would it have to go before it began truly negatively impacting your life? Or is it already?
It actually is. I mean, that's a lot of money. And when you drive, you know, every day to work, and some of us here in our community have to drive more than half an hour, so, you know, it's not putting $20 in the tank every week.
Yeah.
It's now going up to $40 a week.
That's right.
And all these people that are buying these huge SUVs and Hummers that live in a huge city, I don't think they require those kind of vehicles. And I get a little bit upset. I know it's a stigma that, okay, great, you've got tons of money. Do it in a better way. Donate some money.
Well, something really weird happened to us. I mean, back in the 70s, the old boat anchors that were getting no mileage to speak of at all, they all went up on the market when gas got short,
right,
along with people's tempers, I might add. I lived through that time. They were fighting at gas stations. Fist fights were breaking out. It was terrible.
It really was.
And we latched onto the Japanese economy car, and then all of a sudden, oil got plentiful again. And the big cars, even bigger cars, bigger than before, they came back, and now we've got great big boats out there.
And why aren't we tapping into our oil lines here in Alberta? They won't, the government, and it always boils down to the government.
Well, I always had a kind of a cool, I think it's a cool theory that, say, Canada and the U.S. working together, and it was smart to keep our oil in the ground,
mm-hmm,
and buy other people's oil, because eventually we're going to need that oil. So why not? It's cheaper. We don't have to transport it. It's sitting there in the ground. It's not going anywhere.
Exactly. And I mean, with what's going on between the president and the prime minister, that's their story. I know that the Canadians and the Americans I would hopefully would think would come together and say, let's work on our oil together and sell it to each other only.
Do you think that Americans and Canadians, I'll add Canadians, can accept the kind of reality that was in that story? That's pretty hard stuff.
I absolutely do believe in that myself. I'm only 20. I'm ready for reality. I think this whole world needs a reality wake-up call and maybe take a step back. I do believe the government is always hiding information. We can take that even from John F. Kennedy. They won't allow his files to open up for 75 years.
Yeah.
Why do they have to hide things from us? Why is it not only the Canadian government but the American government putting these ideas in our head that we're all five-year-olds and that we don't know how to look after ourselves? With them keep shielding us.
Maybe because they don't know of a solution themselves, and what's the point in panicking us if they don't know what to do? I don't know. That's only one possibility.
You know what? And I agree with that statement 100%, but I think they need to say, you know what, maybe not in our lifetime, Mr. Bell, but in the next lifetime, I think we really need to make our governments know that we all have the right to know exactly what's going on, whether it's going to hurt us.
Maybe in the next lifetime, like that guy was talking about, gas will be 59 cents, but we're not going to get to it in this lifetime.
Unless we, you know, go back to Star Trek ways, right?
That's right. Now, if it came down to it,
mm-hmm.
This is a zinger, you know.
It is.
Came down to it. Would you steal or kill to feed your family?
I would steal. I would steal enough for my family and my neighbor. I would not kill. And if someone came to my door and I had food, I would not kill them. I would share with them.
If it got down to the point where the whole country was going into a deep depression, people were losing jobs,
mm-hmm.
This country was going to hell in a handbasket, would you support the United States going to war to obtain energy supplies?
No.
You would not?
I would not. I would ask that the Canadian and the American government work together and let's get some farm fields going and let's support our farmers. I mean the farmers in America and Canada.
But what if that wouldn't? You know, I'm all for that. This biodiesel thing, I'm all for that for what little it can do, or maybe it can do a lot. We should immediately start on that, but what if that's not enough?
Well,
what if our country was headed for Tin Pan Alley and, you know, on our knees,
mm-hmm.
and some country was preventing us from getting Mideast oil?
Right. That's great. I just feel that, you know, how many more innocent people do we have to kill for a liquid in the ground?
Some people would say as many as it takes.
Well, I
hear you.
I'm a young hippie. I was born in the wrong time. I really think, you know, the soybean ethanol fuel.
Yes.
I really think we need to focus more on that.
But if it's not enough of an answer.
I know it's not. I see these smart cars. There's a few here in London.